listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome. I'm Alan Cardoza. I'm your host, and you're listening to Answers for the Family. Every Monday from 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time to noon, my guests and I will bring you answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Today, we're going to talk about alcoholism. We will discuss some of the warning signs of a potential alcoholic and learn a little bit about the high-functioning alcoholic. My goal today is to educate by helping all of us to be able to recognize the problem and to inspire those that need to take steps to correct the problem. Now, that said, let me tell you a little bit about our guest. I'm pleased to have as our guest today Sarah Allen Benton. Sarah is a therapist at McLean University's new Transitional Living Residential Program for Alcohol Addiction, Drug Addiction, and Dual Diagnosis Treatment in Waltham, Massachusetts. She is author of the book, Understanding the High-Functioning Alcoholic, and has been featured in a New York Times article by Jane Brody, has appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show, CBS Early Show, and NPR. And Sarah somehow finds time to be a blogger for PsychologyToday.com. She's a recovering alcoholic herself and challenges the stereotype of the Skid Row alcoholic by lifting the veil on alcoholics who believe they can hide behind their external successes. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm really glad to have you. When we were scheduling these, I thought, what better time than right after New Year's when everybody's been out celebrating. Obviously, it's a time in which a lot of people go out, a lot of people are drinking alcohol. So
definitely.
Now tell me a little bit about, I guess, first kind of your story, and we'll take it from there.
Sure. Well, you know, I started drinking when I was 14 years old. I was a freshman in high school, and for me, right from the beginning, I was binge drinking, and that was very typical for me throughout my drinking. I was never a daily drinker, and I think that's a real common stereotype of, you know, I must not be an alcoholic because I don't drink every day, and that I learned to not be true. I did really well in high school. I was involved in a lot of activities and extracurricular and sports, debate club, and I had a lot of friends, and I was popular. But when I did drink, I would drink to excess. I would have blackouts, which are memory lapses from drinking excessive amounts of alcohol, and it was something that happened to everybody. I thought that was a normal response to drinking heavily, and I rather liked the excitement of that, which for many people at college, and I chose my college based on a school that I thought would have an ample social life, shall we say, and I chose a large state university, and I continued to escalate the frequency in my drinking at this point. Well, I was drinking several times a week.
Now, the way you described that, was that your way of saying you chose one of the big party schools?
Yes, I did. That was part of my very, very sophisticated criteria. But I increased the frequency in my drinking at that point. I was involved in a sorority, and at this point, I just thought this is what college students do, and I would have there were consequences to my drinking right from the beginning, and they were something that I sort of turned a blind eye to, and I would behave in ways that were not characteristic of myself. I would embarrass myself. I would wake up and not know how I got where I was, and that was from the beginning of my drinking, this type of behavior. But over time, it it seemed normal to me, and it's hard for a social or a light drinker to understand that. But for me, I was, you know, getting good grades, so there isn't a problem, and I kept things looking really good on the outside. And again, I had a lot of friends, and I didn't have too many people saying things to me. And if somebody did say something to me, or I, you know, behaved in a way that I was ashamed of, I would apologize to people and really talk my way out of it. But I went on to graduate with honors, and I moved to Los Angeles, pursued a television career, and I, at that point, around the age of 23, I started to realize that I needed to, I don't know that I wasn't phasing out of this drinking. I thought that this was a phase, that I was going to eventually be a normal drinker and someone that was able to have a couple of drinks, and I started to see that my college drinking ways were following me. So on my 23rd birthday, I stopped drinking for 6 months. It was a present to myself, I guess, in a way, and I really thought this was going to fix my drinking problem, and I would have never labeled myself as alcoholic, ever, because to me, an alcoholic is the homeless bum on the street and the old man, and just not me, not a person that's, you know, a young, attractive, successful professional. And I did that for 6 months. I did not drink. I had horrible anxiety, and I felt I had some physical side effects from not drinking that I never connected with not drinking. I just thought I was allergic to Los Angeles where I was living. But I...
Well, but see, and that's exactly what I was going to say, is that while you were going through that 6 months, a lot of people would say that's proof that you're not an alcoholic because you could hold out for those 6 months.
And I got a lot of that type of response from people, even normal drinkers, who were amazed because they were like, wow, you're not drinking for 6 months? That's amazing. And I would get such praise for that. And I think that it almost also, people that had questions about my drinking, I think at that point it maybe, they probably thought to themselves, oh, she's fine. Look at how she can just stop drinking. And, you know, again, when I started drinking after the 6 months was up, I actually was able to have a couple of times where I drank a few drinks and didn't have a blackout, but I was very, very soon after I moved to back to the East Coast, and I was living on Nantucket Island, and I was very, very soon after blacking out and drinking the way that I used to, and I was in a worse place. And at that point, I did drink daily for about 3 months, along with a lot of other people who were, it was a very party-oriented summer living situation, but I definitely was worse off than I had been before I stopped for the 6 months.
Well, how
I moved to Boston.
And I would say, how much of that do you think was your environment? I mean, it says, you know, you said that you were, when you started drinking on a daily basis, so were the other people around you.
Yeah. I'd say it was a combination. I think if I didn't have that predisposition, I would have been like, oh, I really don't want to drink this much. I also think that the restriction for me of that 6 months of holding back that way, and when anybody has an addiction, whether it's alcohol or food, you know, when you go on when you restrict yourself from that you're addicted to, it can oftentimes, and you don't get treatment. Because right. I had no therapy, no treatment during that time. When you allow yourself to engage in that behavior again, sometimes you swing the pendulum the other way. And I think for me it was that, you know, coming together of the restriction and the fact that I was in this party environment that really prompted that frequency of drinking.
Now I'm curious. Now at some level, might you have ratcheted it up a little bit because you had proven to yourself over that 6 months that you weren't an alcoholic?
I think that I actually, at a certain point, I did journal a lot during these years, so I do recall a journal entry of, I can't believe I'm hungover. I can't believe I drank too much after I, you know, I thought I had fixed myself. But then what happens with addiction is you have almost, it's really referred to as like the Teflon brain, where it's like these bad things sort of slide off your mind and suddenly you don't think you have a problem anymore. And that happened to me. I literally forgot about all the, you know, how I wanted to mature out of this and how I wanted to normalize my drinking. It completely got swept away from my consciousness, which is just a very curious phenomenon. Like when you observe yourself being an intelligent person and yet not being able to be rational around a substance.
Right. Well, you know, that one of the listener questions that came in, and let me ask this one now, but
sure.
I mean, is it possible for an addict to get clean or gain sobriety against their will? So that was one of the ones that was emailed in. And actually, there's a follow-up. Part of that same question was, and if they are unwilling, what can we as loved ones do to help?
Well, I think the first piece of that question is, you know, can a person get sober against their will? Well, you know, yes, they can get sober, but the question is, can they stay sober? You know, there are people that get sober 50 times. The real important piece of all of this for a person who is an alcoholic or an addict is that they maintain sobriety and get into a place of recovery. And if they, you know, sometimes willingness can follow. You know, I didn't want to stop drinking. I mean, I'm an alcoholic. Why would I want to stop drinking? I loved alcohol. Mm-hmm. And I stopped before I had any major losses in my life on the outside. I had more emotional losses. That's really what my bottom was about. So I didn't want to stop drinking. So I wasn't, I guess in a sense, there was a seed of willingness in there. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is the important piece, is fostering that seed in his loved ones, really knowing that, you know, a lot of times people think they need to wait until they want to get sober. I don't want to. Well, of course you don't. You're, you know, that substance has a hold on you, and it's really, that's your love. And so to give that up, it seems like the hardest thing in the world. But really just helping somebody to understand and to get that there's that piece of them that really, that's the piece of them that doesn't want to get sober, the alcoholic piece or the addict piece. But there's a healthy piece in there too. Mm-hmm. And if people can kind of, loved ones and therapists and people in the treatment world can really help to foster that part of the person that does want it. And that's what we need to really aim for.
Now, you just used the word bottom. I think you said your bottom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've all heard that thing of, you know, you're only going to get out of this, you know, if you let them reach bottom. I mean, is that true?
That's a huge, I get that question quite a bit. I mean, first of all, bottoms are all relative, and I think people have an idea, and I had an idea of what the bottom is. You know, I think we see bottoms in the movies where everybody, they're very dramatic, and mm-hmm. people just lose everything, and they finally come to their senses. But, you know, a bottom can be a really subtle thing. It can be a family speaking mm-hmm. with an individual and bringing some clarity to that person where they say, I don't, you know, this is as far as I want to go. So that the bottom doesn't have to hit this horrific low. Everybody does have a bottom. There isn't a person on this, you know, that's sober that didn't have some type of bottom. But I think it's our conception of what this bottom is that needs to shift a little bit, because it can be subtle. It can be a moment of clarity.
Well, and I think that's a great point, and that's kind of been my thought too, but yet I've heard many people out there saying, no, you got to wait till they hit bottom. And I like what you're saying, because to me, it's different for all of us. I mean, for one person, it may be, you know, as you said, part of an intervention or a particular family member that says, you know, I can't see you like this anymore, or,
right.
you know, or for somebody else, maybe it is to the point that they end up having to do something that finds them in jail or in a hospital or something like that. But yeah, I tend to agree that I think it's going to be different with each person, and I don't think you have to wait till somebody's totally wrecked.
Exactly. And a lot of times, you know, there are people who have been intervened upon, or there are people who have. Part of the problem with me was I didn't have people saying things to me along the way, and I'm not blaming other people for that, but the point is that oftentimes high-functioning individuals and alcoholics, and they tend not to get the negative feedback along the way, and that's, you know, another reason why it's so important to speak with loved ones about their drinking, because if they're not having outside losses, which are the stereotypical bottom, you know, mm-hmm. then they're... What can be prompted is a more of an emotional bottom, where they feel as though they're hurting other people, that their drinking is affecting other people, or that they don't want to affect those around them, because many alcoholics think they're only hurting themselves because nobody's saying anything to them.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, and part of this show, again, it's Answers for the Family. A lot of the people that we have out there are parents. Are ed consultants, psychologists, psychiatrists. They're working with families, so much of what they're dealing with are kids who are dealing with these issues. So along those lines, I mean, what are some of the warning signs of a potential alcoholic, and more specifically, as it would relate to a young person?
Well, And I always, you know, preface the warning signs are, you know, if they're taken out of context and you take one of them, that may not be a sign that this person is an alcoholic. So it's always important to kind of look at the big picture of that person. There are some really clear-cut, you know, criteria in terms of that I think are the most important, and then some of the other ones are little flags that are important to pay attention to. So the first, like, four or five that I'd say are so important to look at is, you know, when this person starts drinking, are they able to stop drinking? Do they have a shut off? Or when they start drinking, are they just set off? Is a craving set off and they just drink after drink and lose track of how much they're drinking or not remember it? Another is,
So on that particular one, what you're talking about is the person that when everybody goes out and drinks socially, it's the one that can't just stop when they get to the point to where everybody's having fun. And everybody's having fun and they're laughing and things like that. And this is the person that on the way home has to stop at a liquor store to pick up something to take home, even though everybody else is just going to bed.
Exactly.
Okay.
So this one drink, the first drink, sets off this craving for more, but it's an insatiable craving that this person will continue to drink, and some people will even be not in a blackout and not recall that they're continuing to drink. So it's an insatiable craving that is set off that a normal drinker would not identify with because they would be satisfied after a couple of drinks.
Right. Yeah, they're trying to reach maybe a level of looseness, you know, that, you know, I'm comfortable, and mm-hmm. whereas if the other one is trying to reach, I mean, blackout. I mean, not intentionally,
yeah.
but essentially, until they can't raise the glass to their lips anymore.
And sometimes, you know, this is another kind of difference, is that an alcoholic with each drink typically will feel better and better. With a normal social drinker, they'll keep drinking and feel sick. They'll be like, oh, I feel horrible. So they'll have a motivation to stop drinking. Whereas, you know, many alcoholics just become more and more euphoric and high with each drink, and then that leads them to the blackout.
Now, I think obviously you can speak from experience. Are they really feeling more euphoric with every drink, or do they just think they are?
They are, but they are, you know, again, there's a physiological aspect to all of this, and mm-hmm. alcohol is received in the brain and the pleasure center differently in an alcoholic than it is in a social drinker. So they are actually feeling a different sensation than a normal drinker would feel when they drink. It isn't an illusion, but the illusion is that they are having a good time, in the sense that from what they recall, a person, not everybody blacks out, not all alcoholics do, but there are ways that they're behaving and acting and where they're not having quote-unquote fun, but it's the point of no return. They've already drank and put so much into their system that they can't really reverse it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's, you know, that's one, that's a really important piece of it. Another is, you know, are they obsessed about drinking, in the sense that it's what they talk about, it's what they think about, it's what they schedule their time around. So they're really preoccupied. Alcohol takes up a lot of their time, even if they're not drinking. They're thinking about and plotting and planning who and when and what. So that's another piece of the criterion warning signs. And when they drink, do they turn into a different person? Do they have a personality shift, a sort of a Jekyll Hyde personality shift is a huge, huge flag. And do they behave in ways that are not in keeping with their own moral and values that they would have when they're sober? Again, all part of that. So, you know, there are some like really key, I'd say, flags, you know, blackouts being one of them.
Right.
Really, like, losing items, just not being able to keep track of things, or not even knowing how much they've consumed if somebody were to ask them the next day, not keeping track of their drinks, feeling guilt and shame, you know, around their behavior the next day, expressing remorse, and just clearly expressing that they were acting in ways that were not in keeping with their personality.
Now, would that also go along with the person that feels that you know, they want to have a couple of drinks before they go out and party with everybody else. Like maybe that's a way that other people won't see that they're drinking that much more than everybody else.
Definitely. I mean, pre-partying or pre-gaming, as the terminology goes, is, you know, again, it's a sign of somebody who is drinking for effect. They're drinking to be drunk. Because they're, you know, afraid that when they get to wherever they're going, there's either not going to be enough alcohol or they don't want to spend the money. But the point is that they're trying to get a really good buzz before the actual event. Now, are there a lot of people in, you know, college in particular who that's sort of part of the culture and then they go on in life and they don't drink in that way? Yes. You know, about 72% of people will pass through a heavy drinking period between the ages of 18 and 24 and then normalize their drinking. But there is a population of those who, about 28%, who are not going to phase out or they never drink in the first place. So it's important to not think that just because a person pre-parties, just
right.
because, you know, that they're an alcoholic. So I really like kind of to emphasize that point, but it's still something to look at.
No,
I
was going to say, I absolutely get it because I can remember college days, and for those that came from the world of not having very much money, then some of them, we pre-partied a little bit because it was going to get a lot more expensive once you got to the club. So
exactly. So there is that piece of it that, you know, people phase out of, but it's really looking at the whole picture of this person. You know, are they obviously drinking daily is a huge sign, but that's not always a requirement, and that's a piece where people get kind of confused, like, oh, well, I don't drink every day, so I must be fine. But you can be an episodic binge drinker. But when you do drink, you have loss of control, you know, and you're still having obsessing about alcohol when you're not drinking.
Now,
vomiting while drunk, of course, is a huge one. You know, for people in college, I think a really kind of subtle one is trying not to schedule classes on Fridays, really trying to make sure that they have the maximum amount of time in their schedule built in for being hungover and for, you know, just structuring their life around drinking.
Right. Yeah, I can remember the people who said, well, you know, I'm not going to take any classes on Mondays before noon.
Yes.
In college.
So just, again, this isn't, you know,
well,
just these are some subtle things, but yes, structuring your life. And then that kind of carries over into the workplace. But again, with high-functioning individuals, they will do anything, you know, to show up for work to not feel that they have a problem or that drinking is getting in the way of their life. Like in the case, you know, for me, I never not showed up. I always showed up for work. And again, it was something that I prided myself on, my work ethic and my good grades. So they're not mutually exclusive.
All right. You know what? Hang on. I think we have a call coming in. Let me see if I can do this. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, is this Tony Sweet?
No, you're on the air with Answers for the Family.
Oh, sorry, wrong number.
Okay, thanks. All right. Sarah, are you still with us? Hello? Call on hold. And... Sarah, are you still with us?
Yes.
Okay. Everybody, see, there's one of the reasons why I don't take many calls. it was a wrong number, but it wasn't blocked, and it was actually a local number, and I thought, you know what? I think we've got somebody calling in with a question. And because I don't have a way to screen them, it's always a surprise. So, but anyway, what we were talking about, I think you were talking a little bit... some of the warning signs... and you also mentioned the thing, you called it an episodic binge drinker, and you actually kind of reminded me of somebody I worked with many, many years ago. And what makes it a little scary is that he was licensed to carry a gun, but we would have situations with him. Most of the time, he was, you know, he was very articulate, he was very bright, he could think things through very well, but there would be times in which we would not see him for 3 days. He would disappear, you couldn't reach him by phone, you couldn't reach him at all, and when you did see him, I mean, he had dark circles under his eyes, and we realized what was going on, but he could also go for a very long time not drinking.
Right.
So that's, and is that what you're referring to when you say an episodic binge drinker?
Yeah, and it can be, you know, like that, where you're sort of disappearing for days, or it can be, you know, a couple evenings in the week as the reward for hard work. But when the person's drinking, they're just drinking to excess. And then there's a maintenance drinker, a person that sort of keeps that steady level of alcohol in their system constantly. And sometimes you don't even know that they're intoxicated because they're just at the steady, steady level.
Well, yeah, I mean, it would make sense. If that's how you met them, and they were already like that, and there's no real change, you would just think that's them. It makes sense.
Exactly.
So what are
it manifests in different ways, and that's kind of the key point even around the high-functioning alcoholic. It's not a different type of alcoholic. It's not a different disease. It's the same. Everyone's got the same issue. It's just it manifests into different subtypes,
gotcha.
This being one of them.
So now what about the person that sets drinking limits for themselves? In other words, they go in and they go, tonight I'm only going to have X amount of drinks.
And then they're not able to...
And then they don't follow up. You know, and then it's, well, okay, but, you know, now, I mean, I went over it this time, but I'll make up for it and I won't now drink for the next 3 days. You know, or they're constantly trying to stay ahead of it by giving themselves limits and oftentimes not meeting those.
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question. A lot of times, you know, if a person is spending just excessive amount of time trying to find a way to control and moderate their drinking and setting rules and counting and just, again, in a sense, that is that obsession and that preoccupation. So that's something to keep in mind. There are people who are able to self-correct. They're able to set limits for themselves. They feel like they've started, you know, they drank a little too much for a period of time in their life, and now they'd like to normalize their drinking. So, you know, low-risk drinking limits for, you know, for a male, it's 15... under 15 drinks per week, no more than 4 per sitting. And for a female, it's no more than 7 drinks per week, no more than 3 per sitting. If people are able to adhere to some of those numbers and not be obsessing and fixating and breaking their own rules, then that's, you know, something to look at. Now, if a person is, and I think one of the best ways to kind of establish your relationship with alcohol is to set limits or suggest it, you know, suggest it to a loved one to set limits, low-risk drinking limits, of course, and see if you're able to adhere to them. Because if not, like myself, I spent 4 years trying to control my drinking. Mm-hmm. I set every limit in the book, and I broke every rule. I could not adhere to those low-risk drinking limits. And for me, that was what brought me to my quote-unquote bottom, was this realization that alcohol had control over me. But I think that is a very, very important way for people to realize whether or not they have control over their drinking or their drinking has control over them.
Wow. Well, you know what? We had another question that came in, another listener question that came in over the email, and it said, can a child truly recover from alcoholism while a parent continues as a functional alcoholic?
Yes.
Yes.
And I know of people that have. I know of many people who are sober and their parents are still active, whether they're high functioning or lower functioning alcoholics, but the children are able to stay sober. For a lot of individuals with alcoholism in their family, it can often be for them to see their parent and then to see their own drinking and to say to themselves, you know, for them, their bottom may have been a realization that they were headed in the same direction as their parent, and that scared them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they really don't want to repeat that lifestyle that they saw growing up, and they therefore, you know, get sober. But it is completely possible. And in fact, it can sometimes inspire a loved one to get sober as well, because they see, you know, their child is sober and it inspires them to follow the same path.
Oh, nice. Nice. Well, let's flip that a little bit. And now when we have the parents that are not alcoholics themselves, but they're starting to see it in their teen or they're seeing a drinking problem, what is the best way for the parents to initiate a conversation with their teen about drinking alcohol?
Well, it is important to keep the lines of communication open. And that, again, not to tell, you know, it's not giving the message that there are no rules and anything goes, but that you as a parent would rather hear the truth about what is going on with them than to have the secrets. And I think it's also important to put it in the context of, is there a history of alcoholism in your family? Because mm-hmm. if there is, you know, genetics account for 50% of the chance of developing alcoholism. So it's also important to let your child know the family history, as if, you know, there were diabetes in the family or something else, so that they, as you know, they're growing up, they can sort of have this awareness in the back of their mind. And it's also a good starting point in terms of conversation around drinking. Important to articulate and let people know some of the information I was sharing about, you know, what it means to have a drinking problem or to be alcoholic, you know, that it's about your relationship with alcohol and helping your child to examine that relationship and to see if, you know, alcohol, if they have any of those warning signs, and just to keep an eye on themselves. Part of my problem was I had no information about alcoholism. I had no frame of reference. And that's part of why I wrote the book that I wrote, was so that there would be a frame of reference for people like myself who were sort of sliding through school and work and doing well, but yet were still alcoholic. I didn't have a framework. It is important to really let even starting drinking before the age of 15 can increase a child's chance of developing alcoholism at any point in their lives by 40%, regardless of family history. So even having a dialogue around, you know, if they could just postpone when they start drinking, it could really, really decrease their chances of having a problem in the future. So just even having a conversation around, like, you know, it's unrealistic to expect that a child's never, ever going to try alcohol.
Right.
But really that, you know, just information, education, but also that you'd rather hear the truth about it so that you could help them to get help if something were going on than to have lies and secrets.
Well, and I think that's great advice. You're right. It really does come down to communication. Now, you had mentioned about you had started in, I think, a sophomore or freshman in high school?
Yes.
How did you keep it from your family?
I slept out a lot at friends' houses. I just wouldn't. I had very strict. I came from a very strict rule family, and so that was, you know, for me, it was I hid my drinking because I was very afraid of being punished or not being allowed to drink, and so I started this double life that so many alcoholics live. I started at a very young age, really this perfect, you know, perfect on the outside in terms of, you know, the grades and all of that, but then the drinking was just out of control right from the beginning.
Well, and I think you touched on something else that's important too, and that is that you said that you had kept your grades up. So a lot of the times in which the parents may think, well, you know, the warning sign would be that their grades would be dropping, or the warning sign would be that, you know, that there's other issues going on. If you've kept your grades up, it sounds like that was part of the facade, was they went, you know what, I'm not going to touch on these things because something must be going right because their grades mm-hmm. are okay.
And that's a huge thing. I sometimes I feel like I'm the bearer of bad news when I say that. You know, there are people who, and, you know, I interviewed many sober, high-functioning alcoholics for my book, and the stories of people who made it through medical school, who were star athletes, who were doing well in school, were astounding, because that, I think, is the way that people are sort of trained to, you know, well, grades will slide, or they're not going to show up for school or classes, they're going to miss classes, their athletic performance is going to slip. That's not necessarily the truth. Again, over time, things may start to deteriorate, but for high-functioning people in particular, the last thing to go for them are their grades and they're going to work, because we cling to that as our sign that it's really not that bad. We're really not that out of control, or we can't be alcoholic because look at us, look how well we're doing on the outside. So no, that's not right. necessarily the flag that parents can measure if their child has an issue with alcohol or drugs. It's definitely a sign, but it's not a requirement.
Right. And yeah, and I can add to that as someone who transports kids to these programs is we have transported the star athletes, we have transported the straight A students. You know, it isn't just, you know, this myth that, you know, that once this starts to happen, they're the ones whose grades are going to drop and you're going to have all these other problems. Now, let me, you mentioned the book, and just want to remind everybody, okay, the book is called Understanding the High-Functioning Alcoholic, and if anybody is interested, I mean, where can they pick up the book, or is there a website they can go to?
Yes, highfunctioningalcoholic.com is the website. For the book, there's also resources on there for alcoholism and treatment, but the book is available on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and through the publisher, ABCClio.com, but there are links to that on the website.
All right, that's great. And again, we are talking with Sarah Allen Benton. The book is Understanding the High-Functioning Alcoholic. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a minute. And Sarah, what I'd like to do at that point is... Mm-hmm. I'd like to role play a little bit, and I'm going to become a 16-year-old boy with an alcohol problem. All right?
Sure.
We'll be back in 1 minute.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
All right, we're back. And I have now brought us up. All right, now, so our role play will be, I'm a 16-year-old boy who came home at 1 a.m. and threw up on the carpet. You're the parent. It reeks of alcohol, so the first question, do we talk about it now, or do we wait in the morning when I wake up?
Okay, and the drum roll. You would definitely want to speak with your child in the morning, when they are sober or hungover. You never want to speak with someone who has about their drinking when they're under the influence for a variety of reasons, but it's pretty much a wasted conversation, literally. So, you know, again, you want to make sure that if they did get sick, so you do want to make sure that when they're sleeping that they're on their side that evening. You don't need to get into a dissertation conversation with them, but you want to just make sure that they're safe and that they're not going to be on their back, because if they vomit in their sleep, they could
die.
Suffocate. So that's
right.
Just a safety issue. But in the morning, obviously they're actually the most receptive sometimes, because there is a certain letdown when a person is hungover and they can be a bit more vulnerable even than the following day. So it's a good time to catch them.
Okay.
And, you know, sometimes you can, again, it is important to not come on so strong that they just close up and clam up and don't have an open dialogue with you. So even though you may be feeling afraid and feeling angry or whatever emotions as a parent you may be having around this, it's important to kind of hold back enough so that your child is able to speak openly with you and not fear your reaction.
Okay. All right, so with this one, okay, I'm 16 years old, I've just started driving, and, I got home at 1 o'clock in the morning, and the first thing that I did was throw up on the carpet. So what you're saying is, and it reeks of alcohol. So you know why I threw up.
Exactly. It's,
you know, in other words, this isn't one of those that the first thing is going to be that I can lie, you know, to try to lie out of it. You know, it's, you know, it reeks of alcohol. So the first thing you've done is you've just put me to bed, made sure I was on my side.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm waking up in the morning. You're the parent. How do you handle this? And this is a relatively new thing. In your mind as the parent.
Well, you know, I would first start off with just asking your child, do you feel that you can be honest? You know, and I don't know if you're speaking with two parents and one child or however, but do you feel that you can be honest with us? Do you feel like we're parents that you can talk to about what's going on? Just to kind of see where they're at and if you're going to be having an honest dialogue. Because if they're saying, no, I'm afraid, no, I'm afraid of getting punished, no this, no that, then that's the conversation might have to go in a different direction where many, many parents will tell their children, I would rather you call me and I will come pick you up than, and you would not, you know, almost say an amnesty policy, like we will not punish you if you call us, we will come pick you up, because the drinking and driving piece is just so horribly, it's just so risky.
Absolutely.
But, you know, kind of seeing how they perceive it.
Okay, so I, then your first question now of me, this 16-year-old with a hangover, is you're saying, so at this point, maybe a single mom, son, do you feel that you can give me you know, honest answers to questions I have for you about, you know, your drinking of alcohol?
Exactly.
Right? Okay. So that being your first question, and my answer may be, I think I can give honest, give honest answers. I think I can be honest about it. I would think the parent's next question then is going to be, you know, how long has this been going on and why haven't you told me about it? You know,
mm-hmm.
You know, so if it's the how long has it been going on, I think I'm probably not going to be as honest about that. You know, at 16, I'm going to go,
right.
You know, it's really new. It's just started.
Right. And I mean, they're also pretty much assuming that this conversation is heading towards being grounded or punished in some way.
Right. So you don't want to give any greater thing. It's like, I'm not going to extend the amount of time I'm being punished by saying, yeah, I've been doing this for a year and a half. You just didn't
exactly. Notice. So maybe even laying some groundwork. Some parents, you know, again, there are different parenting styles, so I can't say across the board there's just one way to have this conversation. But if, as a parent, you don't really want to get into the punishment aspect of it, but you're more concerned with the open dialogue piece of it and them understanding that, I mean, you may have never said to them, because you didn't think they were drinking, about, I will come pick you up if you're ever, you know, too drunk to drive, or your friends are too drunk to drive. Like, I would rather come than you driving home in this state. And getting beyond the punishment piece so you can have an honest conversation. And other people, that's not the way that they would go. But I think that you would have probably two different conversations depending on that aspect of it. I would even maybe ask, like, who they were with, because you might want to just get an idea of, if they are being honest with you, of who of their friends, because you may know their friends,
right,
is engaging in this behavior with them. Just for the future, it's good to know kind of who of the friends are in that mode.
Okay, so go ahead and ask that question. So now at this point, you've asked me if I'll be honest, and I've said yes, but then you've asked me how long it's been going on, and I've inferred that it's really new, and in the back of your mind, you probably don't believe it, but you're going to go on. So you're saying your next question is, so who were you with? You know, you originally told me you were going to go out with Johnny. Who were you with? And I might then go, I was with Johnny for a little bit, but I really don't want to tell you the other people I was with because I don't want to get them in trouble. I don't want to be a snitch. I don't want you calling their parents.
And, you know, just saying, you know, I'm not at the point of calling them. I just wanted to know if, you know, which of your friends are kind of, you know, into drinking, or is this something that are they drinking with you? Are you drinking and they're just kind of, you know, what's going on? Do you feel like you're drinking more than your friends? Because that's the other piece of it is,
Well, okay, but let's say that's your question. Let's stay in the role play. If that's your question, and then I might go, well, you know, actually I drank less than them because I was driving.
I would say, well, that's scary. No, absolutely, but
I'm saying, but I said that on purpose because it is scary, right? Because you're thinking, wait a minute, you got sick and threw up all over the,
exactly,
the rug, and you thought you were okay to be the designated driver?
Exactly. So maybe even defining what designated driver means.
Right.
It doesn't mean the less, you know, the least drunk of the wasted. It means the sober driver.
Right.
And reiterating too, the law. I mean, I don't. It's 0.02, which is pretty much not even a drink for underage drinkers.
I think you just shared something that at least I didn't know, and maybe a lot of people didn't know. It's 0.02 now.
Yeah, for underage drinkers.
Oh, for underage.
For an underage person that gets pulled over, the drinking limit is 0.02. It's 0.08 for over 21.
Okay, good. Because I was going to go, wow, it was 0.08 the last time I checked.
I know. No, but if you're underage, it's just so low, you could barely have anything.
0.02, you could probably reach that with NyQuil.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, not everybody's aware of that.
Yeah, I wasn't. I'm glad you shared that. And you're right that's an important thing that the kids should know,
mm-hmm.
Which is a great point. Designated driver is not the person that happened to have had the least to drink. Designated driver is the person that was set up originally that would not drink at all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good point.
Exactly. And sometimes there's confusion around that, especially when they... If they're going to engage in, instead of having, it's something you plan ahead. You don't wing it at the end of the night. You establish it at the beginning of the night.
Right.
And I think because people lose judgment, hence you.
Yeah.
You lost judgment last night.
Yes.
So.
Okay. So what are you going to do? I mean, what are you going to ground me? I mean, I didn't crash the car. I didn't do any. I mean, I got home okay and I don't think that I had, until you just told me that it was 0.2, I don't think I had enough that I thought I was legally drunk.
Well, if 16. You're vomiting, it's safe to say that you drank a good amount of alcohol if you're vomiting.
Maybe it was the jalapeno burrito I had.
Possibly, but I'm going to assume that you had too much to drink.
Because it did smell like that, right?
Yeah, like, I mean, alcohol. When I looked, yeah, the odor was of alcohol.
Right.
Yeah, and also, you know, is this something that, a lot, just on a side note, some people when their first time drinking, they do get very sick. So, you know, just, is this something that I'm just finding out about now, or, I mean, have you drank like this before and just not driven? Just some quizzy questions, but with an energy of openness, whether you're not, because you could end up grounding them, that's fine, but you do want to get almost as much information as you can get when you're in a calmer state with them, because that's really how you're going to kind of assess, is this something that this person is regretting and remorseful? Like, you know, I that would be a good question. You know, is this something, did this scare you at all? Like, how are you feeling about this whole situation?
Yeah, how does the headache feel right now?
Yeah.
Have you felt this before? You know?
Yeah, and thinking about, you know, the fact that you were driving, and I don't know what else occurred before getting in the car, but was there anything about the evening that was scary to you? Do you feel that you drank too much? Again, trying to get their perspective on, oh no, I was fine. This wasn't a lot. Like, you're kind of getting, you're getting information about their relationship to alcohol.
Right. So what you're saying is to gather as much information as you possibly can, and the parent who jumps immediately to, you're grounded, the car's being taken away, you're not leaving the house without me by your side, and you'll not be driving the car for the next month. Although that might end up becoming a consequence, don't do it first, because you're not going to get any information.
Yeah, and also, I mean, I'm sure that they probably expect that something is going to happen as a result of this. But again, if you go in with that energy of you're in trouble, they're not going to say anything, and it's really hard for you to get a picture of what is going on that you don't see.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not to say that they, you know, wouldn't lose their car privileges or whatever. And in fact, it may be a good safety insurance to take the car away, because if they are going to be sneaking and drinking and because it really is, I mean, the number of deaths from drinking, I think it's one of the top causes of death for people under the age of 21.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard that as well. So, okay, well, let's see. Any other questions we can put in here? I've just looked over at the clock. We've only got a couple of minutes. Oh, actually, I've only got about 30 seconds. Okay, so real quickly, I'm sorry, I got all carried away with our role play. So again, anybody, if you have any additional questions or you're looking for resources in this area, you can go to www.highfunctioningalcoholic.com. That is Sarah's website. You can check that out. You can also get the book that way, or you can find it in Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and so on. Sarah, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it. I think you've really helped to not only educate, but hopefully inspire some people to do something about it.
Well, thank you so much for having me and for addressing this topic. It's a very important one for people of all ages.
I agree. So, again, thank you, and for those listening, we will be right back with a couple more words. Thank you, Sarah. Bye now.
Thank you.
All right, now, and for those of you listening, please check out our new blog. It is www.answersforthefamilyblog.com. It's answers, the numeral, for the family, blog.com. To do that, you can view details on upcoming guests and future shows. I would love your comments on today's show. So go to our blog, give us that information. If you have any suggestions of guests or topics, please go to the blog. You can list those there as well. And you can also listen to any of the past shows. Again, thank you for listening. Have a great week, and we are out of here.
You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.